Talking History with Patrick Gagan. This is News Talk.
We shall fight on the beaches, we shall fight in the hills, we shall never surrender.
And out of that silence came thousands of voices.
The strategy of the white man has always been divide and conquer.
It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
Auch den Leuten, Argus.
Good evening and welcome. We're talking history on News Talk 106 to 108 with me, Patrick Gagan. In tonight's show, we're exploring the life and times of the Irishman who defeated Napoleon and became Prime Minister of Britain, the Duke of Wellington, and we'll be debating his complicated relationship with this country. You can send us your thoughts and comments to talkinghistory@newstalk.com. This year is the 165th anniversary of the opening of the Wellington Monument in Dublin, and in tonight's show, we want to explore the life, legacy and relationship with Ireland of the Duke of Wellington. Arthur Wellesley, later the Duke of Wellington, was born in Dublin in 1769 into the Anglo-Irish Protestant ascendancy. He would go on to become one of the most famous military commanders in European history, defeating Napoleon at Waterloo in 1815 and becoming one of the defining figures of 19th century Britain. But Ireland never entirely disappeared from his story. He served as Chief Secretary for Ireland and as Prime Minister forced through Catholic Emancipation in 1829. And so in tonight's show, we want to explore the life, legacy and complicated relationship with Ireland of the Duke of Wellington. And to help me do this, I'm delighted to welcome our panel of experts. Dr. Sheila McGuckian is an historian and lawyer with a DPhil from Oxford and a PhD in history from University College Dublin. She's the author of the wonderful new book, Anglesey in Ireland, 1828 to 1833. Gareth Glover is a former Royal Navy officer and one of the leading military historians of the Napoleonic Wars, with more than 40 years spent studying Wellington and his armies. He is the author of numerous acclaimed works, including With Wellington's Cavalry, Waterloo Myth and Reality, and the multi-volume The Waterloo Archive. Professor Michael Browers is Emeritus Professor of Western European History at Lady Margaret Hall at the University of Oxford and is one of the world's leading historians of Napoleonic Europe. He's the author of the acclaimed three-volume biography Napoleon, as well as Europe Under Napoleon, and he's also the editor of Volume 1 of the Cambridge History of the Napoleonic Wars. Well, you're all very welcome. And Sheila, I might begin with you, and I might begin with the Irishness of Wellington, because despite being born in Ireland, he's never really recognised as an Irishman. But it's something that I think hangs over. It's a shadow that hangs over his legacy.
I think that's very true. He certainly didn't say it, and it wouldn't have reflected his sympathies or his opinions at all. He was, one of the issues with him in Ireland in recent years was the fact that he was part of the Anglo-Irish, the Protestant minority class that was ruling Ireland at that time. And he did actually spend, of his first 40 years, Ireland was very much his centre of gravity. Although during those years, he spent 7 years in India, where he really made his reputation. And he also was educated partly. He was initially educated in Ireland and actually in White's Academy down on Grafton Street, where Bewley's is now, very close to us here. But he then did his secondary education, firstly in Eton in London and then in Angers in France at a military academy. But on every occasion, he came back to Ireland at that time, because although the family was disengaging from Ireland because they had lost their father had lost his money and they had to sell their estates, it was still the place where they had most influence and most connections. So, you know, over those years, he would go abroad. He quite often would end up actually fighting battles. But when they were done, the place to which he came back was Ireland. And it was here that he had his initial appointments as an aide-de-camp to the Lord Lieutenant when he was a very young man. He was an MP in the Irish Parliament. And there were certainly years from between when he was about 19 until he was 24, 25, when he was properly happy in Ireland. But it became very clear to him that there was no great future for him. After being appointed Chief Secretary of Ireland, which was a really serious post, he was in the post for 2 years, from 1807 to 1809. But during those 2 years, each year he left for at least 4 months, the first time to go and fight in Denmark, and then he came back and didn't do very much as a chief secretary, and the second time to go and fight in Portugal, where he was very successful at the Battle of Vimera, and then back again to Dublin while he planned his escape to get to the peninsula. So although he is somebody who's very much looking abroad, Ireland keeps bringing him back. And certainly for those first 40 years, it is his centre of gravity. And also the idea that he didn't like Ireland just isn't right. He's not a man that was, you know, likely to express his emotions. He was very taciturn. But an example of what he thought about Ireland can be seen in 1829 when he was introducing the second reading of the Catholic Emancipation Bill. And what he said was that he had spent more time fighting than most people. And he said, "I must say this, if I could avoid by any sacrifice whatever for even 1 month a civil war in the country to which I was so attached, I would sacrifice my life to do it." And that's not the attitude of somebody who didn't like Ireland. But again, you know, his politics being very much regarded as British, being very much regarded as part of the empire, particularly his time in India, and being so disliked by Daniel O'Connell, meant that that part of his life was very much overlooked in Ireland.
And it really does show the tensions or that complicated relationship we have with that Anglo-Irish identity and with people who have or go on and develop careers in Britain, because sometimes in Ireland we're very quick to claim someone of Irish descent or Irish legacy, but here we have someone who, you know, defeats Napoleon at Waterloo, who goes on to become British Prime Minister, but because of that Anglo-Irish connection and because he's perceived as being maybe an enemy of Irish nationalism, we don't really want to acknowledge him, even though there is that Wellington monument that was opened 165 years ago.
That's correct. And actually, there's a big Wellington monument in Trim as well, where the family estates also are. It's true. And actually, the other surprising thing is he is the person that introduced Catholic emancipation. And maybe we'll talk about it a little bit more in detail in the future. But it took somebody like him, of his stature, who was viewed as a conservative, as somebody who was supporting, you know, the British system, to persuade King George IV, who was very difficult, unbelievably opposed to it, and was dying at the time. And essentially, after huge machinations, when it had finally been brought up and was about to be debated in the House of Lords, like, the King was reneging, and Wellington essentially bullied him into letting it go ahead. And I don't think anybody else could have done that. So it might have been certainly until after George III died, and who knows if his brother William IV would have agreed either. And, you know, that's something that really is can be credited to Wellington, I think.
I was at a wonderful event in the Stephen's Green Club in Dublin just before Christmas, and it was built around the anniversary of the birth of Daniel O'Connell, but the present Duke of Wellington was the special guest, and he spoke very powerfully and movingly about his family's connections with Ireland and the role of his ancestor in passing Catholic emancipation, and it was clear that it meant a lot to him. Mm-hmm. And it really brought home, I think, that this is an aspect of that story that is often neglected and overlooked.
Well, that's correct. And also, you know, as far as the Duke of Wellington's ancestors are concerned, it wasn't merely the Duke who was Irish. His wife, Kitty Pakenham, was Irish, and she was part of a large, very close Irish family. And two of her brothers became his very, very close friends and followed him, fought along beside him throughout the Peninsular War and at Waterloo as well. And actually, the interesting fact about Daniel O'Connell, Wellington, and Napoleon is that they were all born within 3 months of each other, the same summer of 1769. So strangely, they had that in common as well.
Gareth, can we talk about Napoleon now that he has been introduced into the discussion? Because when you look at the two of them as military commanders and as generals, I think Napoleon is often seen as the genius, the mastermind, the one who produces these extraordinary victories at Austerlitz and so on. And Wellington is seen as the chance victor of a battle, which was how Daniel O'Connell dismissed him. And I think Wellington doesn't quite get the credit, perhaps, as a military commander. Or is it the case that Napoleon was so far ahead of him?
I think what you've got to look at is the fact that they had a different way of actually managing their troops. Napoleon was loved by his army, and he was able to engender that love for him and belief in him. Wellington worked on a different principle. He worked on discipline. He actually worked on ensuring that whatever he said to be had to be done was done. And he drove his army into a position where they could actually win battles. So they are very different characters. And what you have to look at with Wellington is the fact that he really had an army greater than the army he was facing in a battle. Most battles he fought, he was on the defensive. He was commanding Britain's only army at the time and couldn't afford to lose it, whereas Napoleon certainly had the resources of almost the entire continent of Europe and therefore could allow himself to lose large numbers of men and replace them. And that changes the aspect of them. Both of them are actually highly established generals, able to command their troops exceptionally well on the battlefield, but have different aspects to them. As in, Napoleon could throw large numbers and win battles. Wellington won them with small numbers.
I wonder, Gareth, whether it was the Peninsular campaign that really was the making of Wellington, and that he learned the significance or just how important terrain was, and he learned so much about logistics. And you really see the defeat of Napoleon in that campaign, not just for what was happening there, but also in the way he was developing as a commander.
You're right, but his early days of learning were firstly in Holland, when he actually learned how not to fight a battle and command an army by watching how badly they were commanded there. But he learned an awful lot about his logistics in India, where any army manoeuvring across the Indian plains there of the Deccans, they literally had to have thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of followers behind them, manoeuvring with all of the actual goods they required to actually feed them, etc., on the road. So he actually became very prolific at that. The only problem for him is that his great victories, like Assaye in India, were largely downplayed in Europe. This was fighting armies that were seen as not being as proficient as European armies of this time, and therefore easily beaten. I mean, I think Wellington would argue against that on many occasions when he actually had to fight huge numbers. But certainly that sort of knowledge helped him in the peninsula, and his ability to set up the system so that his troops in general were actually supplied very well throughout the campaigns, whereas the French struggled with their system of actually trying to live off the land and finding that large areas of the bare sort of plains of Spain couldn't supply them very well and they starved. That was the basis on which he established his army. And as he actually said himself, by 1814, he felt he had the best army in Europe and they could achieve anything if given that task.
You mentioned how loved Napoleon was by his troops. I wonder what they made of Wellington, or what Wellington made of them, because there's that famous quote that I think he backtracked a little from about how they were the scum of the earth. And I wonder what was his view of the troops, and maybe what was his view of the significant number of Irish who were in the army?
Well, there's a couple of things there. The first to say to you is with regard to his using the phrase the scum of the earth, you're quite right. He used it, we have references of about five times he used it, one or two of which were about the army. Usually when he was had gone through a bad period and actually felt that he needed to sort of chide his troops for actually failing to do what he'd asked them. But the overall concept you have to bear in mind is the infamous speech where he actually says that they were the scum of the earth. He actually continues and actually says he's effectively saying they were largely drawn from the dregs of society. But what he's then said is, but we turned into those wonderful troops. And it's quite clear that he had a great affinity for those troops. And in fact, you know, just before Waterloo, he actually was going through the park and somebody said, how do you plan to win this battle? And he just looked and pointed at a soldier that was staring at some bushes across the way and said, give me enough of that and I will win this battle. And that's really what he's about. he unfortunately had a poor turn of phrase at times, which came back to haunt him. But realistically, that's not what he was about. And I would actually bring up the subject of Ireland. With regard to the numbers in the army, there was about a third of the army was clearly Irish. And that is obviously a huge part of his army. But what I would say is that it actually does bear relationship to the number of people that then lived in Ireland. Around about that time, Ireland made up about one third of the population of the UK. And therefore, it's not surprising in that sense. But certainly the Irish contingent was particularly renowned, certainly in, as hard fighters in battle.
Michael, it's very interesting to look at the contrast between Wellington and Napoleon as military leaders. One of them seems to be improvisational, charismatic, aggressive. The other, Wellington, more cautious, disciplined, deeply methodical. And it seems to be a brilliant way of counteracting the genius of Napoleon to approach, to not to try and match his style, but to try and defeat it in a very different way.
Well, I'd be interested to know what Gareth thinks about this, but when you say you look at the peninsula, I mean, the only time they actually faced each other was at Waterloo. When you look at the peninsula, Wellington didn't have a lot of choice except to dig in and play defensively. But he also had the great advantage of that he could be supplied by sea through Portugal. You know, that influences things a great deal, I think, in my opinion. And the fact that he can operate within a small area. You know, the smaller the area is, the easier it is to defend, as my friend Charlie Estelle always says when he's talking about Spain, and I think he's right. Napoleon comes out of a very different way of thinking. It's not just a personal thing with Napoleon. Right from the beginning of the Revolutionary Wars, the French general staff have a way of looking at things. They want to break with this 18th century style of warfare that Wellington is still part of. That you move methodically and slowly with your big supply train behind you. And they push this aside for the war of movement. And they're all behind this. Napoleon's been trained in this. And all his peers are devoted to it. You know, it's not just a personal thing with Napoleon. It's generational. You move fast and you travel light. And that works beautifully in Western and Central Europe, where you've got rich countryside, where you've got good infrastructure, that works fine. You get it into Spain, you get it into Eastern Europe, you get it into the Middle East, in Egypt, it disintegrates. You know, it's not just a question of personality. It's a question of tactics that the revolutionary armies have completely developed. But, you know, one of the things I found very interesting when Gareth was talking about was it Wellington's attitude to his soldiers, the almost misquote of the scum of the earth. But this is something Napoleon makes great play with in a great many of his encounters, not even so much with the British, but with the Eastern armies, the Russians, the Prussians, the Austrians. It's often very moving stuff to read that the French are an army of free citizens. They may be conscripts, but they're citizens. They're free people. You know, they come from peasant families. It could almost be De Valera. These fellas are taken from the best of their country and they give the best of it on the field. And that's why nobody can match them. They're free people. You know, the contrast he draws with the armies opposing him is always striking. And that's always it. You're free. And yet, of course, what that does neglect, and it's something that Wellington and Napoleon do actually have some common ground, is if you look at the backstory of how those fellows became French soldiers, they were conscripted. The conscription process in France is brutal. It's carried out by the gendarmerie, a paramilitary police force. These guys literally descend on peasant villages. They descend on peasant communities throughout France, and they round them up. You know, there's a very high, bureaucratic, highly sophisticated process of sifting who's eligible and who isn't, and who's going and who isn't. But boy, when it comes to the cutting edge, it's cutting all right. And yet, I mean, within months, these guys go to the depots and they emerge, like you were saying, fanatically loyal to Napoleon, fanatically loyal less perhaps to France than to the army. You know, and that's something that the two commanders have in common. I think, you know, you want to know how battles are won, look at those men. And Napoleon always regarded them as his family. And insofar as was possible, enormous provision was made for the orphans and the widows of the army. You know, there's pensions being paid, dowries being provided for the daughters of fallen soldiers. You know, it's quite a tale, really. And it does show you that there is a certain amount of common ground here.
And Michael, is part of the brilliance of Wellington the way he studies the methods of Napoleon? It's clear that he respected him, but that he also understood his weaknesses. He understood how Napoleon might overextend himself or make mistakes.
As I say, they only faced each other once, and that was at Waterloo. He didn't spend most of his career fighting Napoleon himself. And I think that's one of the most interesting things about Waterloo. They both came there with reputations and with ideas about each other, but they didn't really know. You know, they didn't really know. He obviously had studied Napoleon up to a certain extent because he was the most successful general in the world in the first decade of the 19th century. But I think a great deal of what he found simply wasn't applicable to his circumstances. He was there in Portugal and in Galicia, and it was going to take him time to get out. A great deal's made about the campaign into Salamanca and the victory where he caught the French B team, basically. But the best thing that came out of that was a very orderly retreat back into Spain because he didn't have the resources to push forward. You know, he soon found out that he had to bide his time. Napoleon was the exact opposite position. Where you actually find something that he maybe did look at was the 1814 campaign in France, when Napoleon is on the defensive and actually plays a very good hand. You know, they're operating in very different circumstances.
Well, tonight we are talking about Wellington, his military career and his relationship with Ireland. We're going to take a quick break now, but when we come back, we'll be refighting the Battle of Waterloo and finding out about the winning of Catholic emancipation. So stay with us here on News Talk. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about Wellington, his military career and his relationship with Ireland. My brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Sheila McGuckian, is an historian and lawyer. She has a DPhil from Oxford and a PhD from University College Dublin, and her recently published book is The Wonderful Anglesey in Ireland, 1828 to 1833. Gareth Glover is a former Royal Navy officer and one of the leading military historians of the Napoleonic Wars, with more than 40 years spent studying Wellington and his armies. And his books include Wellington's Cavalry, Waterloo Myth and Reality, and the multi-volume The Waterloo Archive. Professor Michael Brouwers is Emeritus Professor of Western European History at Lady Margaret Hall at the University of Oxford and is the world's leading historian of Napoleonic Europe. He's a specialist in the French Revolution, Napoleon and the reshaping of Europe after 1789, and his books include the wonderful three-volume biography Napoleon, as well as The Napoleonic Empire in Italy and Europe Under Napoleon. And he's also the editor of Volume 1 of the Cambridge History of the Napoleonic Wars. Sheila, I wanted to talk to you about an element of Wellington's psychology and personality, and that is the way he seemed unwilling to share information to people. He liked doing things his own way. He didn't seem to really want the advice of others. And you see that playing out during the passing of Catholic emancipation. But you also see it at Waterloo when he's unwilling to tell Anglesey anything, even though Anglesey is worried that Wellington might be killed in battle, and in which case no one will know what to do.
That's correct. So Lord Anglesey, who became Lord Lieutenant of Ireland when Wellington was Prime Minister, and the two of them together argued over how Catholic emancipation should be enacted, had in his earlier life been Lord Uxbridge. And he was a cavalryman, and he was the second in command of the Allied armies at the Battle of Waterloo. And on the night before the major battle was due to take place, and it had all unfolded quite quickly, things had moved quite fast, but it was clear on the night before the final battle that the final act was due to take place the next morning. And Anglesey had a moment where he thought to himself, my goodness, I'm number two here. If anything happens to Wellington, I am the one who's going to have to take over. So he felt he would just have a quick word with Wellington, and he said to him, you know, look, if anything should happen tomorrow, can you let me know, you know, what you're thinking, what your plans are? And Wellington turned to him and said, well, Napoleon hasn't shared his plans with me, and as I don't know what he's going to do, there's nothing I can tell you. And that was it. With that, Anglesey had to be satisfied. And what's interesting about that, obviously the next day unfolded as it unfolded, and in many ways, Wellington wasn't wrong. But I mean, some idea might have been, you know, reassuring to Anglesey. But something similar then happened when Anglesey was Lord Lieutenant to Wellington's Prime Minister. The Lord Lieutenant is the King's representative in Ireland. They're the person that's actually present in Dublin. So for bringing in emancipation, the three really crucial people would be the King himself, who has to agree and sign it and agree to allow it to go ahead, the Prime Minister, who was pushing it forward, and the Lord Lieutenant, who's actually in Ireland. And although Wellington had come round to realise that it was going to be necessary to bring Catholic emancipation in, and he had disclosed this to his Home Secretary, Robert Peel, they decided not to tell anybody else. The only other person they told was Lord Lyndhurst, who's the Lord Chancellor. And the reason for this was because things that Wellington really, really felt very, very strongly about were the monarch and the constitution. And Catholic emancipation was going to have a huge impact on both of those, because the monarch at the time was George IV, who was very old. He was dying, and he was rapidly anti-granting any rights to the Catholics, because he had this notion that his oaths that he had taken on his coronation just forbade him to do this, and it would be very bad for his father's soul, and he just did not want to do this. So because of the way the cabinet had been established, Wellington believed that they couldn't discuss it even at cabinet until the King agreed to allow them to do this. And he took this very seriously. Now, this was a very, very strict approach of what had been agreed that Wellington took. But he more or less stuck to it. And of all the people that he didn't tell the Lord Lieutenant of Ireland, who was Anglesey, who was, you know, in Ireland facing increasing tension, increasing problems in Ireland. And he kept trying to tell them, you know, you've no idea what's going on here. Everything has changed. You know, we've had this election. Daniel O'Connell has been elected. Everything has changed now. And although for the last, you know, since 1800, we've had various, you know, attempts to get Catholic emancipation, they've always been knocked back. This time, you know, we must go ahead with it. And Wellington just wasn't prepared to entertain that, wasn't prepared to give any indication that he changed his mind, and wasn't prepared to give any indication to Anglesey. Now, Anglesey knew that that was something he might do, but he could get no indication from him. And, you know, it reflected his experience with him at Waterloo.
And he even fights a duel over it. And I think, again, people in Ireland aren't aware that the Duke of Wellington is there fighting a duel based on this issue.
Well, yes. I mean, so what had happened about that was, the Duke of Wellington, you know, was head of the Tory party at the time, which was, again, very much the royal party. But the election of Daniel O'Connell to the Parliament in 1828, as I say, it changed everything. Because what had happened was, in Ireland, the franchise was quite limited, but there were about 215,000 people out of a population of 7.7 million, so it wasn't that great. But there was a population who could vote. And the vast majority of that population, I mean, more than two-thirds of it, was made up of people who were Catholic, and were the 40 shilling freeholders. And this meant that they owned, or leased realistically, land worth 40 shillings, which was about £2, which was a very, very small amount. So you had this very large number of voters. And it hadn't been a problem in the past because they were all tenants. You were required to vote publicly, and pretty much they were regarded as the property of their landlords. Like, they were brought down anytime there was election, they were brought down to the voting booth, and they had to publicly declare their choice, which would have been for the landlord's choice. Because if they didn't, they could end up, you know, having their rent put up, being evicted. You know, they have very, very little choice in this. And what O'Connell and his Catholic Association had managed to do was, by a system of what was known as the Catholic rent. Everybody paid a penny a week to the association. And this allowed the association to build up a fighting fund, if you like, so that tenants and Irish people could take a risk. And if they were going to be evicted, well, then, you know, the Catholic Association would look after them. So first time that this was kind of seen was in the 1826 election, when a number of Protestant individuals who supported the Catholic cause were elected, running against very strong Protestant families. And that was quite shocking. But they weren't sure, you know, would this continue? But it certainly did, because in 1828, as a result of a by-election, Wellington had appointed an Irish man, Vesey Fitzgerald, to his cabinet. And he was forced to resign his seat and then, as the rule was at the time, run again in a by-election before he could take a cabinet post. And this was felt to be a very safe thing to do, because Vesey Fitzgerald, very, very popular landlord, had always been viewed as somebody who took the Catholic side seriously, and he was expected to win. But unfortunately, when Wellington had been appointed Prime Minister at the beginning of the year, O'Connell and the Catholic Association had declared that anybody who supported Wellington's administration was to be opposed by a Catholic Association person against them. So what happened was, in June 1828, O'Connell and the Catholic Association couldn't get anybody, any Protestant supporter of theirs, to run, because Vesey Fitzgerald was just so popular. So in the end, about a week before the election, O'Connell decided, well, there was nothing for it but for him to run instead. And this was a huge risk for him in terms of his career, and a real, you know, watershed moment. So what happened was, in June, in Clare, in 1828, against a very popular local landowner, O'Connell won by a landslide. And the crowd behaved perfectly. The Catholic Association managed the whole thing brilliantly. And this was so alarming to the British government. They realised that this had changed everything. And in fact, when later explaining to the king why this had changed everything, Wellington explained that because more than two-thirds of the voters in Ireland were these 40-shilling freeholders, it meant that any time they wanted to try to dissolve Parliament or appoint anybody to the cabinet who had an Irish seat, of which quite a few of them did, they couldn't. They were effectively paralysed. And that was the huge change that that had made.
And I want to mention a wonderful event that you're taking part in on the 30th of June, Tuesday the 30th of June, organised by the groundbreaking research project, the Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland. This incredibly rich resource, it's available free of charge, open access online. But you'll be speaking on Lord Anglesey. Tim Murta will be speaking about Catholic emancipation and a collection there. And Joel Herman will be speaking about the Irish links with the American War of Independence and the Declaration. So if people are interested in that, they can just go to the Virtual Record Treasury of Ireland website and they'll find all of those details. Gareth, can I ask you about Waterloo itself then, and how close a run thing it actually was in the end, whether Napoleon could have won, and why it was that Wellington won?
That's a question that could be answered in about 3 days. Waterloo is a battle where anybody could have won at different times. It's really the three-day campaign that ends with the Battle of Waterloo. Certainly, Napoleon, in the early days, invades into Belgium and actually catches the British and the Prussians, because there were two armies there, Wellington's army and the Blücher's army of Prussians, which were separated, and he manages to keep them separate and has a draw with the British at Quatre Bras, and defeats the Prussians at Ligny, and believes he's driven them out of Belgium on the retreat to Germany. So therefore, Wellington retreats to the position at Waterloo, a position he had chosen because he was very much one for planning ahead, and he had this battlefield in his pocket, as he said. He retreats to Waterloo. But he knows that the Prussians are not completely defeated and are going to join him there, that's their promise. Napoleon doesn't think they're coming, and therefore he is caught out by the Prussians late in the afternoon, and that's why he is largely defeated. But Wellington's aspect to this is that, one, he is superb at the defensive position. He knows how to protect his troops behind slopes so that they're actually not under huge cannon fire on a regular basis, and only brings them forward at the right moment. He has never dealt with Napoleon directly before, but he has fought the French marshals for many years in Spain and Portugal and southern France. And he, as he describes it, he knows the French system and he knows how to beat it. And he is relatively confident he can hold his ground, but because he is commanding an army of a conglomerate army of Germans, Dutch, Belgians, and sort of British, he actually is unsure that all aspects of his army will hold and fight as he knows his British troops will. So he is very worried and wanting Blücher to arrive. Blücher's final arrival late in the afternoon, much later than Wellington actually expected, did lead to the victory. But the main thing I would say about Wellington's victory that day is the fact that he was personally everywhere all of the time. The fact that he actually survived himself through the battle is miraculous, because he was everywhere. Wherever the firing was hottest, he was there personally seeing his troops through these difficulties and pushing back the French on each attack. And that is really his great claim that day of actually winning the battle, because clearly it is a joint battle won with the Prussians. But his personal sort of bravery and keeping his army in position until the Prussians arrived to change the situation was his major effect on that day. For Napoleon, he clearly had lots of chances on the days before, but by the time of Waterloo, he had actually lost most of his chances. He really, with two armies closing in on him, had lost the battle the day before.
Michael, I wonder, how would you rate Wellington as a politician when you look at his later political career? How successful was he there, do you think?
Well, I find him a very interesting contrast to Napoleon, and it's not really in the way people would think. He obviously, from what I know, found cabinet government impossible. You know, he didn't really know what it was about. I gave them their orders and they went on talking. You know, it may be apocryphal, but it does sum up, I think, what a lot of people in their memoirs said about him. He gave his orders and that was it. And that explains a lot of it. I think Sheila put it very well. You know, he didn't have a good turn of phrase. It could be badly misunderstood. The military aspect was difficult enough within the army. The way he kept things to himself, obviously in politics, that's going to be something similar. And I think he was often badly misunderstood and manipulated by someone, say, as we were hearing, by someone like O'Connell, who was a politician to his fingertips and very clever at spinning things and taking Wellington out of context. But Napoleon, I find the contrast very interesting. Napoleon, completely the opposite of the caricature of the dictator, was tremendously good at what Wellington wasn't as a politician. He knew how to handle a committee room and was a committee man. He was a very good chairman. But in the Council of State, he establishes the forerunner of keeping it all in-house. He said, we go around the table, everyone gets their say. We go around the table, everyone gives their report. We establish a consensus. But once we do that, we stick by them. This is Chatham House rules. Nothing leaves the room. But we stick together as a team. And he did it a remarkably similar way with his own marshals. He would meet, he would explain what he intended to do, any other suggestions, and if there were some good suggestions, he would take them on board. He would look for consensus among everybody, so that everybody, in theory, knew what they were supposed to do and what he was aiming to do. He would even take it up to some of the frontline troops and say, okay, fellas, this is what your sector is supposed to be doing, and this is why. Completely different to Wellington. And I think that explains a lot about Wellington as a politician. He couldn't leave the military aspect behind him in some ways. I would, from what I've gathered, Napoleon did. Napoleon knew how to handle a room full of people and treat them as equals. And he knew how, he was a good listener. His whole ethos whether it was as a civilian leader especially, even as a military commander, was communication.
Well, tonight we are talking about the Duke of Wellington and indeed his connection with Ireland. We're going to take our final break now, but when we come back, we'll be exploring the legacy of Wellington. Welcome back. We're talking history, and tonight we are talking about the Duke of Wellington. My wonderful panel of experts, Dr. Sheila McGuckian, who's an historian and lawyer, Gareth Glover, a former Royal Navy officer and one of the leading military historians of the Napoleonic Wars, and Professor Michael Browers, Emeritus Professor of Western European History at the University of Oxford. Sheila, let's talk maybe about the legacy of Wellington and indeed maybe how he's remembered in this country. Do you think we should remember him more and that we should separate the life from the mythology that has grown up around him?
I'm not sure necessarily that we should remember him more, but I do think an acknowledgement of the fact that he played a role in Catholic emancipation is something. Very few people are aware of that. And in terms of that whole period, it's all very much about Daniel O'Connell, and there is no doubt that Daniel O'Connell was the author of what happened. It would not have happened without him. But even with that, it did require somebody of Wellington's strength and determination to push it through. Because interestingly, even after it had been agreed finally that the king had said that Catholic emancipation could be debated by the cabinet, and they went ahead very, very quickly. And over the years, people had all sorts of things about how would it be granted, what would its limitations be, what would its restrictions be, would there be vetoes, would the government appoint bishops and everything. And this had gone on for 30 years. And then from the announcement in the King's speech on the 5th of February that they were going to consider it, the bill was actually in front of Parliament by the 5th of March, within a month. And what was decided at the time was just to do something very simple. They were just going to get rid of the oath of supremacy. And what that meant was that previously, although there was nothing to stop, as happened with Daniel O'Connell, a person running for Parliament if they were a Catholic, but in order to take their seat, they had to swear what was called the Oath of Supremacy. And this meant, obviously, swearing loyalty to the king, but it also meant that they had to reject all the tenets of the Catholic faith. And that was the bar. So it was decided simply, rather than doing anything more complicated, they just changed the oath. But at the same time, the quid pro quo that they asked for was they abolished the 40-shilling freeholders. And that meant, I mean, unbelievably, the franchise of Ireland went from about 215,000 to between 20 and 30,000. So it was very, very effective. So with that, that passed through, it had few difficulties getting through Parliament. But at the very end, the last thing that it had to do was to be debated on the final days. And just before the debate was due to happen, the king decided he changed his mind. And on the night of the 4th of March, he said, no, I can't do this. So in the middle of the night, Wellington and Robert Peel, the Home Secretary, who had supported him massively, both had to go in and see the king. The king was like, no, it's not happening. And it was due to start the following morning. So Wellington said, that's it, I resign. The whole cabinet's going to resign. We're going to tell everybody why we're resigning, and you're on your own. And off he went. So anyway, the king changed his mind, brought them back in the middle of the night, and it was decided they could go ahead. And that is how he forced him to go ahead. So it took somebody like that to do the intricacies of it. So, you know, his legacy is important because he did bring it through at a very important time for Ireland and at a very important time for Daniel O'Connell. We got the benefit of Daniel O'Connell as the terrific politician that he went on to become. So that was, you know, very valuable. If it had been delayed another 10 years, maybe we might not have got that. So in some ways, Daniel O'Connell's terrific political reputation was, surprisingly, a little bit facilitated by Wellington.
And Sheila, for someone who we've described as a taciturn individual and, you know, quite serious in the way he approached his military career and his political career, in terms of his private life, it was certainly much more racy, and he certainly didn't care about external scrutiny. His famous publish and be damned when some extramarital affairs were being threatened with being exposed. And very interesting to look at those dynamics as well.
Well, he's very interesting on that. I mean, he's a very interesting man. He had a very unhappy marriage, a very sad marriage. Very early in his 20s, he had fallen in love with Kitty Pakenham, who was the daughter of Lord Longford in Ireland. And her family had said, no way can you marry our daughter. You're just, you know, at the time he was about 24, and he said, you know, you've no prospects, and sent him packing. And so he went off to India, became very successful. And when he returned in 1806, he hadn't seen Kitty, and they weren't even allowed to write to each other. And they were match made by a friend of hers. And he, whether it was out of pride or whatever it was, he said, yes, I will marry you, even though I haven't seen you for 7 years. And she gave him chances not to pull out of it. And he said no. And literally the first time he saw him in 7 years was on the morning of the wedding. And he's supposed to have remarked to his brother, who was accompanying, by God, she's grown ugly, which is a terrible thing to have said. But it was a very unhappy marriage. She was very quiet, very shy. She adored him. And he was very, very impatient of her. And what was particularly sad about it was he really did enjoy the company of women. I mean, yes, there were quite a number, well, I'm sure there were a huge number of lovers, but he was quite discreet about that. But he also had a lot of very close, very deep friendships, platonic friendships with women. And there are letters that he discussed. And it was such a pity he couldn't have had that with his wife. And as far as the lovers are concerned, you know, he was reasonably discreet about it. I mean, there were far more. There's huge conjecture as to who was and who was just a friend and who wasn't, which kind of speaks to his discretion. But perhaps that was, you know, to protect their reputation. The famous publisher, Madame, that was Harriet Wilson, who had been a courtesan, and she had threatened to publish what she claimed were letters that he had sent. He was just like, yeah, I don't mind about that. He didn't feel her reputation was in any way likely to suffer from the fact that she had had a relationship with him. So he did. He was quite complex. You know, he really liked women.
Gareth, how do you think we should remember Wellington, and what do you think his military legacy is, and how is he regarded as a military commander today?
Within the British Army, certainly he is still revered as a great commander, plucking many of a victory sort of out of the jaws of defeat, should we say. And also managing in an incredible way. I mean, if you ever read his voluminous volumes of papers, the workload he went through to ensure that his army was able to move and actually fight, but was also fed, etc. He brought all of that professionalism to it. And that was his real legacy. In fact, his legacy to the later period of the military wasn't so great, because by the time of the Crimea, much of what he had been looking at has obviously fallen behind regarding the sort of weaponry available. And therefore, he is sometimes blamed in some ways for the army not being really ready for the Crimean War. But in other areas, I think it's quite useful to look at him as a person. His whole aim in life was complete and utter, completely sort of placed in that he wished to ensure that everything protected the monarchy and the constitution. And that is what he's about. And as we've heard, you know, when he saw the constitution was under threat, he would dig his heels in, but they would then move dramatically when he felt that the alternative to bending would be revolution or something like that. And that's obviously clearly, he felt it was more important to keep the status going and sort of therefore keeping the actual government under control. But I will bring one thing up. I don't know if you actually know about this, but in 1834, the king actually asked him to form a government. And as he was in the Lords at the time, he refused to do so. He actually suggested that the king ask Robert Peel. Robert Peel was actually on holiday in Italy at the time. And the king said, well, who's going to run the government until he arrives? And Wellington said, well, I'll do it, effectively. And the king said, well, you appoint some ministers then, obviously, for the different areas. No, I will actually run the entire government until Peel arrives. If I appoint anybody, Peel will feel that he has to keep those people in post when he arrives. So he actually, at one period, for about 6 weeks, was Prime Minister, First Lord of the Treasury, Secretary of State at the Home Office, Foreign Secretary, and Minister for War at the same time. And he toured each of these offices daily to ensure that the correspondence was moving on, etc., but wouldn't make any major decisions or anything else until Peel arrived. And when Peel arrived, he promptly handed over everything to him at no thought would Wellington have ever thought of turning this into some sort of opportunity for him to become a dictator of Britain? It would be the last thing he ever considered. And that's the side of him that I admire. He was very much for the system and actually ensuring that the system worked.
Michael, I'm going to leave the final word to you. How would you assess for us the legacy, the reputation, the lasting impact of the Duke of Wellington?
He was the man who stopped Napoleon at Waterloo. More importantly, he was the man who masterminded the Peninsular War, which I think was the single British contribution on land. But I think he was the epitome of the best of the British system. There was no question of his loyalty to that system. He was never going to exploit it. You could depend on him in that point of view. But there is something else that I think would be interesting to end on. And that's an interesting bit of common ground he had with Napoleon that had never really occurred to me until I listened to Sheila and brought the information together. Napoleon, too, was a great champion of religious liberty, of Jewish emancipation especially, but of the emancipation of all religious minorities. Wherever he held sway, he was determined to impose this. And you can see the same kind of attitude in Wellington with Catholic emancipation. This is something that's sane and has to happen. And that, I think, is something intrinsic to Wellington, I think, was his sanity, his ability to know that a system had to work and it had to be fair, and yet it couldn't move beyond tradition. And he struck that balance brilliantly. He wasn't always popular. He didn't care. And as a symbol of his times, but I think particularly as regards emancipation, he really does deserve to be remembered. And I would say in Ireland rather more than he is.
Well, I think that's a wonderful note on which to end our discussion tonight. My thanks to my absolutely brilliant panel of experts, Dr. Sheila McGuckian. And as I say, you'll be able to see her in person at that virtual Record Treasury of Ireland event on the 30th of June. Gareth Glover, who's a former Royal Navy officer and one of the leading military historians of the Napoleonic Wars. And Professor Michael Brouwers, Professor Emeritus of Western European History at the University of Oxford. Well, that does bring us to the end of another edition of Talking History. My thanks to my producer tonight, Aoife Breen, and to my series producer, Mairéad O'Sullivan. Join us again next week for more debate and discussion. We've been talking history. Good night.